The optimal management and treatment of NETs relies on an early diagnosis, shared decision-making, and timely referral. When best practices are in place, patient outcomes can be maximized. The best possible patient journey will be impacted by regional differences in management strategies, referral pathways, and availability of diagnostic modalities and treatments. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Ed and supported through an independent educational grant from Ipsen. In this first episode of a two-part podcast series, two experts focus on regional differences in NET epidemiology, diagnosis, and referral strategies. I'm delighted to introduce them to you. Professor Rachel Reckelman, a medical oncologist and clinical scientist focused on colorectal, anal cancers, and NETs. She's currently director of the Clinical Oncology Department, AC Camargo Cancer Center in São Paulo, Brazil. And she also serves as the president of the Brazilian GI Tumors Group. And then we have Professor Martin Kaplan, who is professor of gastroenterology and GI neuroendocrinology at the Royal Free Hospital and University College in London, UK. And he also leads the Royal Free London European Neuroendocrine Tumor Society Center of Excellence and the UCL Academic Neuroendocrine Tumor Unit, which includes leading scientific and clinical research programs into NETs. We're very much looking forward to your discussion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this podcast. I'm Martin Kaplan from the Royal Free Hospital in London. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in neuroendocrine tumors. And I'll hand over to
Rachel Reckelman, a medical oncologist based in São Paulo, Brazil. I'm currently head of department of the clinical oncology department at AC Camargo Cancer Center, and I am a NET specialist there.
So it's going to be really interesting to have the different perspective from South America and Europe. So we're going to have some really nice discussion. The plan, I think, will be to look at the pathways to diagnosis and the best practice for the workup of patients and treatment of patients. But initially, I think we'll start off with discussing types of neuroendocrine tumors and a little bit of the epidemiology, just to have a setting from where to work from. Rachel, are you happy to give a little bit of the background of different types of neuroendocrine tumor?
Sure, Martin. Well, as you know, we're talking about rare tumors. Not that rare as it was before, right? The incidence is increasing. And we're, at least in Brazil, the more people do colonoscopies and endoscopies, we see, you know, incidental NETs that, you know, sometimes patients come for evaluation. But in Brazil, we do not have formal statistics, but in clinical practice, we see mostly what we see in the literature from studies in US and Europe. So most of them are NETs from the small bowel, gastric, as I said, incidental finds in endoscopies. And sometimes lung NETs that are found in as incidental nodules in CT scans. I see, as a medical oncologist, I see a lot of small bowels and pancreatic NETs, because these are the ones that tend to be more metastatic, unfortunately. And what about you?
So I guess we see much more as the European and states, the experience is similar, small bowel, neuroendocrine tumors be top of the list, and then the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and then other types. But one never forgets the bronchial neuroendocrine tumors probably account for up to a third of all neuroendocrine tumors. And of course, the incidence and prevalence has been just rising over the years, and the SEER data is very impressive. You could see probably a fivefold increase over 30-year period. And has that been your experience as well in Brazil, in terms of noticing much more than in the early days?
Yeah, we have, you know, and particularly appendix NETs. I don't know if people are just making more diagnoses today, but it's not uncommon to see young patients coming to the emerge and having an acute appendicitis and then go to surgery, and then that ends up being an appendiceal NET. So I see that a lot. As a medical oncologist, I don't see a lot of initial lung mets.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thoracic oncology colleagues, they see a lot. You're right. I think it's a global trend.
Yes. And I guess, you know, the other thing that comes out of the US SEER data is different ethnicities have different incidence and prevalence. So you would see more in the way of rectal neuroendocrine tumors in the Afro-Caribbean Black population and Hispanic as well to a large degree. And then do you see in South America, do you see ethnic divides as well in that sense?
You know, in Brazil, the population is very mixed.
Mm.
So, you know, people just marry each other. So it's all really mixed up. So everybody's mixed, you know. Everybody has someone in a family that is of African descent or Japanese descent, Italians, and so it's very hard to see this. So we don't see ethnicities as a segregation for types of NETs. But do you see that in your clinical practice?
Yes, I suppose the Black Afro-Caribbean will be more prone to developing rectal NETs, and I suppose, you know, one looks worldwide at the data coming out of Japan, South Korea, where rectal NETs are seen in the Far East much more commonly. Then I guess it's pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors there, and much less in the way of small intestinal NETs in the Far East. I think the data coming out of India, I think in terms of their epidemiology, is quite interesting in that they're probably seeing a little bit more in the way of pancreatic than small intestinal NETs. And I think it is intriguing to understand the ethnicities and the then molecular profiling ultimately in those different ethnicities. And actually, as to what you're saying, it would be more complex to do that molecular profiling to look at distinct groups because of
it's all mixed up.
The mix, which will be happening more, I guess, throughout the world. But certainly the epidemiology is interesting. Every country seems to be showing that increase as well. And I guess for the audience, we should just put into perspective the different types of neuroendocrine tumors in terms of the grading. Do you want to go through the grading aspects of it?
Well, based on the most recent WHO classification, NETs, NIN, neuroendocrine neoplasia, is classified in three different grades, three types, I would say. So grade one is the more indolent one. Usually this is measured in the pathology by Ki-67 in immunohistochemistry expression and the number of mitoses. So up to 2% expression of Ki-67, we call that this would be a G1 or grade one NET. And this classification is for the gastroenteropancreatic NETs. Then the G2 Ki-67 goes from 3 to 20. Above 20, then tumors can be well differentiated or it can be a neuroendocrine carcinoma. And this is really, really important to understand because the treatments and the prognosis is very different. So the well differentiated NET G3 are generally treated more like G2 NETs. While the neuroendocrine carcinomas are very aggressive diseases, and sometimes they tend to be treated just like a small cell lung cancer. But they are very rare, even more rare, which is fortunate. But this, what I like the audience to be aware of is that, you know, the accurate diagnosis is crucial or prognosis are to decide on the treatment strategy. So if in doubt, just ask for a pathology revision in a center of excellence you can trust.
I think that's the key, isn't it?
A lot of misdiagnosis, do you?
Yeah, because the pathology review is so important. And even in patients referred to us from sort of mature centers or good centers, actually even the grading can change. And then there's the whole question, of course, of adenocarcinoma with neuroendocrine differentiation. Being sent as a neuroendocrine tumor, which is completely inappropriate. And that's a big challenge in terms of, you know, wanting to get the message back to the referrers that adenocarcinoma neuroendocrine differentiation, you treat as the adenocarcinoma. It's not a neuroendocrine tumor just because of that differentiation. And I guess you must see the same issue.
Yeah, and depending, Martin, on the tumor type, you have not only all the treatments, but you also have, you know, with standard molecular profiling that you have to evaluate. So, for example, if it's a colorectal neuroendocrine carcinoma or colorectal, or if it's an adenocarcinoma with neuroendocrine differentiation of the colon rectum, you have to evaluate microsatellite instability, the RAS and the BRAF mutation, for example. So as you said, it is really crucial to have an accurate diagnosis, because that all treatment will depend on this.
Yes, no, absolutely. And let's go back then and talk about the patient journey to the clinic and for diagnosis, because one of the big things, you know, even in the UK, and it was published that the number of visits to the general practitioner, the primary health carer, before they get a diagnosis or referred on, was somewhere between 9 and 11 visits with the symptoms. And so you're seeing this incredible delay before patients are diagnosed, and often when they are, it's with metastatic disease. And it's the same experience with you as well.
Yeah, I think this is also a global phenomenon. Because, you know, in Brazil, most oncologists are the physicians that treat metastatic disease, and most are general oncologists. So it's not uncommon that they are not familiar with NETs, and the pathologists also are not familiar with NETs, and then there's a misdiagnosis or a delay in starting treatments or ordering CT scan or having access to certain imaging tests. For example, the gallium PET is not accessible to people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We've got the same. I think the average time is between 3 and 7 years. It could be in that pathway. Let's just touch a bit then on that pathway of how patients are diagnosed with neuroendocrine tumors, and how do they get to you, first of all? How would the patient get to you?
Well, I work in a comprehensive cancer center, so most of the patients come first to see the surgeon if they have a localized disease or symptoms or whatever. But also, because patients are aware that we have a center of expertise in NET, once they have the NET diagnosis, they come. They come for a consultation, I would say as a second opinion, or even to be treated. But in overall in Brazil, I would say that many patients come to the general practitioner first because of symptoms. And they, if they don't think of NET, then that's why, you know, patients take a long time to have the diagnosis. And then it takes time to be referred to the medical oncologist here.
And do you have a regional, so we would have a setup whereby eventually the patient gets referred to probably their local hospital, and then the local hospital will do some of the tests, and there'll be an MDT, which ultimately will refer to the specialist center. Is that the same sort of program that you have, and how are the centers known for those centers of expertise? How are they known? How do the patients find their way to the centers of expertise, such as yourself in Sao Paulo?
Well, you know, the health system, Martin, in Brazil, it's I would say, most classified into two types, the private and the public. In the private setting, patients are more aware of centers of excellence and how they can get referred or ask for a second opinion. In the public system, usually they come from a basic health unit. And then once they have the diagnosis of a cancer, whatever cancer it is, and then the cancer services have up to 2 months to start treatment. This is the law. So once the diagnosis is established, then, you know, patients have to get any type of treatment within 2 months, which is, I think, is reasonable. The problem is that it takes time sometimes, especially for NET patients, to be diagnosed, to have, you know, biopsy and the colonoscopy, whatever. So that how that would work. But in the public system throughout the country, there are centers of cancer treatments where patients are referred to based on their geographical location. Of course, that treatments are, not all treatments are available. So for example, lutetium PRT is not widely available, but somatostatin analogs, chemotherapy, radioembolization, surgery, liver transplant are available.
Yeah. And the, because we have the same issues of the delay will be, you might have to wait 4 to 6 weeks to get the gallium PET scan to help stage the disease. And this seems to be a worldwide problem that is the, how do you get access, you know, equitable access to those scans, if you can get it at all, because many patient centers won't have access to gallium PET. And, you know, the octreotide scan, the tetraide scan is good, but not as sensitive as the gallium PET, but can tell you gross burden of disease or whether there's gross uptake, I guess. And in terms of, take us through then the diagnosis pathway of your workup then for a patient with neuroendocrine tumor.
I think the first two things that I try to have is first accurate pathology. So I really have to be sure what I'm dealing with, and then to know what is the primary tumor of origin. So this may not be that easy sometimes in the first consultation. Many patients have what we call the unknown primary tumor with metastatic disease to the liver. So I think it is important to evaluate even with a gallium PET or with immunohistochemistry. Let's say there's an expression of CDX2 or SACB2, you know, in front of you have a patient with a small bowel NET, for example. So having an accurate pathology and knowing the primary tumor, the primary organ of origin, it helps a lot. And of course, then staging. In terms of biomarkers, I order a 24-hour 5-HA, urinary 5-HA to all patients with small bowel and lung NETs, regardless of symptoms, because I see about 10 to 15% of them have an asymptomatic elevation of the 5-HA. But for pancreatic NETs, I order only biomarkers if I have a suspicion of a hormone secretion by the tumor. And I never ordered a chromogranin A.
Right.
For some reason. Well, first, it's not reimbursed at all, so patients have to pay for it. And also because, you know, it's very common for patients to take PPIs, and then chromogranin is usually elevated when they're taking PPIs. Everybody likes to take PPIs. And then if there are, you know, changes in chromogranin A throughout the treatment, it may help inform if there is progression, but it's not going to make me change the treatment strategy. So in overall, I think I can save some money not ordering chromogranin A, because I don't think it helps a lot. What do you think?
No, I think that's right. It is rather non-specific, the chromogranin A. We do it because I suppose if it's elevated significantly, then you can follow it to a certain degree. But it is, you know, it's not such a great marker even in the situation of following treatment. So it's okay. It can be helpful, but not more than that, I think, because it is so non-specific and just variable. In the other thing is the type of chromogranin A as well, because there's so many different types of assays, and so not, you know, your assay will be different to our assay as well. So it's not interchangeable from that perspective.
Let me just ask you, do you order FDG PET in any situation?
Not for every situation. For high grade neuroendocrine tumors, we will always do an FDG PET. Right. We've got a particular interest in looking at gallium versus FDG PET imaging. So all the well differentiated ones will have gallium PET. Those where we think that, which are high G2 and certainly G3, we would probably get an FDG PET. And the other time we would get an FDG PET if the tumor is just acting more aggressively than you think, then we'd probably also get a concurrent FDG PET with a gallium PET in that situation. So I think there is a role for FDG PET in certainly in the higher grades and where the biology it seems to be more aggressive.
I agree. But do you have access? Is this accessible throughout the country?
Yeah. So in the UK, yes, certainly for FDG PET. And many of the sort of expert centers for neuroendocrine tumors will have access to a gallium PET. We've got one on site, and there are patients within, if in other parts of the country, who might only have access to ultratide scans or tetratide scans could get referred to a nearby center for their gallium PET. So they could get that for sure.
Thank you very much for this interesting and insightful discussion. We've learned a lot about the importance of early diagnosis and referral strategies, as well as the impact regional differences can have on these. Don't miss episode 2 of this podcast, in which the experts discuss treatment and future developments. In addition, look out for another podcast in which a consultant in gastroenterology and neuroendocrine tumors and a person living with NET discuss shared decision-making in NET treatment, including self-injection scenarios. If you enjoyed this and want to find out more about NETs and how to manage people living with NETs, then please look for the other resources from NETConnect under the account of Core2Add Medical Education. Also, don't forget to rate this episode and share it with your colleagues. Thank you for listening and see you next time. This podcast is an initiative of Core2Add and developed by NETConnect, a group of international experts working in the field of neuroendocrine tumors. The views expressed are the personal opinions of the experts. They do not necessarily represent the views of the experts' organizations or the rest of the NETConnect group. For expert disclosures on any conflict of interest, please visit the Core2Add website.